Yes. Yep. Okay. Thank you, Jordan, and welcome everybody to today's teleconference, Eliminating Discipline in Safety for Process, or for Success. This is going to be a great time that we're going to talk about a way that we can move away from disciplining employees and we can make them a part of the process that will help the workplace become more productive and less stressful for everybody. I guess one of the biggest questions as we start off is, what is discipline? You know, discipline in the workplace is the means by which supervisory personnel correct behavioral deficiencies and ensure adherence to established company rules. The purpose of discipline has been to correct behavior, and in the eyes of an employee, it's almost become a way to punish or embarrass them. And that isn't the end result that we want. But over time, the perception of an employee is that discipline is not a good thing. You see, the essence of the word discipline alone brings up negative reactions to most people. I mean, it does to me. I say that to overcome this perception, it's going to be better to use a positively perceived approach and to solve the problem rather than a negatively perceived approach. So the question is, how do you make discipline into a positive, especially when there's a negative perception of it? Because of this, I will boldly state that employers should actually refrain from disciplining employees. But instead, I believe that we need to move into what I'm calling a resolutionary process. Now, you may say that this is nothing more than semantics, that we are arguing over a trivial point or distinction that resolves around mere words rather than a significant issue. But I tend to disagree with those that hold that belief. You see, the power of positive words should never be ignored as a very effective way to communicate with employees and gain their cooperation rather than resistance. You see, we have too much resistance going on in the workplace today. If we had more cooperation and employees and supervisory and management was moving in the direction of accomplishing the end result in a positive manner, we wouldn't have as much conflict. We wouldn't have as much stress. Conflict, understand, is not a bad thing. Conflict is good if it's not personal, because conflict generally lets people know that people are concerned about what's going on. But this is not an area that we need to have conflict in. We need to be working together in this area to make sure that the end result is going to be realized. If you take a look at the next slide, you see Donald Trump there. And you can go through life with the Donald Trump approach, which is you're fired, or you can use an approach that not only will foster cooperation, but will make the employee part of the solution and self-accountable. You see, I feel, and my experience has shown, that what happens is that if we do not make the employee a part of the solution, then they will always be a part of the problem. And what we need to do is we need to make them a part of the solution. We need to hold employees self-accountable for their actions and for their reactions. And this can only be accomplished when we're all working together in a positive manner toward accomplishing the end result. The end result, most of the time, is the serving of the customer. Whatever the customer needs, that's what the end result is. Whether it has to do with production, whether it has to do with quality, whether it has to do with quantity, whatever it may be, but the end result is serving the customer, and we need to learn, management and employees together, need to learn to be able to work together. If we take a look at the third slide, one of the first things that I want to do is I want to address assessing employee behavior. This is important because once we understand why certain employees act a certain way that they do, then we can better address them when it comes to making sure that compliance of set rules and regulations and requirements are being met. I generally categorize employees into three groups. Group one, as we see here, is the can-do employee. This, of course, is the ideal type of employee. I mean, this employee usually has the training, the support, the motivation to do the job, and they do it. If all employees were like this, the job of management would be a lot easier. More importantly, these types of employees are motivated to do the job. There could be any number of reasons why they're motivated. It could be the money. It could be they really enjoy the type of work that they're doing. It could be the internal gratification that they get for getting the job done. It all comes down to some sort of external or internal gratification. Maybe you have never seen a can-do employee, and I hope that's not true. I've had the pleasure of working with several, and I found certain characteristics. Number one, they are dependable. When this employee is told to do something, they don't stand around and argue, well, it can't be done that way. They consistently work on finding a way to get the job done. They may ask questions to better understand what the end result needs to look like or what the parameters are, but once they understand, they will work on accomplishing that job at hand. They're also able to work independently. They don't have to have someone standing over their shoulder keeping an eye out for their every move. They would prefer that you not do that. I know that as an employee, I would prefer that you not micromanage me and stand over my shoulder. Many a manager makes the grave mistake of micromanaging a can-do employee. They generally do this because they have been burned in the past by employees, and now they treat everyone the same way. The final result is that they will alienate the can-do employee, and it insults their character. This leads to an unhappy employee and the loss of a good employee by either turnover or a negative behavior change. The second characteristic of a can-do employee is generally they have a good attitude. A can-do employee is upbeat and positive. It makes it easier for them to do their job. How often have you been around a negative employee and all they want to do is whine and complain? Pretty soon their attitude is affecting the attitude of other employees. Try walking around hunched over and a frown on your face and think positive at the same time. I'm going to tell you, you can't do it. A can-do employee, however, uses good posture. They get around with fellow employees and management alike, and typically you'll see a smile on their face or a twinkle in their eye. Good attitude employees are team players. They're always looking for a win-win outcome. They're asking questions. They're proactive. They are great role models for other employees and often make good supervisors as well. Their can-do attitude can be infectious. And everybody, yes, even the naysayer, comes to respect them for what they're able to accomplish. The next characteristic of a can-do employee is they have a willingness to work. One of the big problems that I find in workplaces is the lack of desire. The lack of desire to work or do a good job goes hand in hand with the lack of desire to learn. There are a few reasons for this lack of desire. A lot of it has to do with experiences that they've had in reference to learning in the past. If they did not enjoy the learning style they were that was forced upon them in school, then they eventually became bored in the process and they quit learning. A can-do employee continues to learn. They enjoy the process and the satisfaction that they receive from the journey and also completing the process. They then take the material that they've learned, they apply it to the situation that they're involved in, and because they have more knowledge, they also have more confidence and are more willing to take risks and work outside of the box. On the other hand, you probably have employees who use learning as an excuse to get out of work. A can-do employee is not lazy. They have excellent attitudes and accept responsibility for their failure. But the neat thing about a can-do employee is that as long as they are treated with respect and trust, they will not let that failure hold them back from moving forward and accomplishing the assignment. This allows them to learn from the mistake and be flexible in the process to fix the challenge and achieve the desired end result. This type of employee sets and achieves goals. Change is not their enemy. It may not be their friend, but it is a process of the journey, and they realize that. When the can-do employee is sidetracked for whatever reason, they simply have to refer back to their goals to get back in the game. They may have to modify the goals or the rest of the target, but seldom are they forced completely to abandon the final objective. The other characteristic about a can-do employee is that they use downtime productively. What does a can-do employee do when they have nothing to do? The answer is not nothing. A can-do employee is always doing something. As mentioned earlier, there are great lovers of personal development, for example, and learning new things. One thing that you will find is that they are readers. The adage goes that all leaders are readers. It may be true that all readers may not be leaders, but you will find that all leaders are readers. There is a plethora of information through many sources. Some of you may be involved with the National Safety Council. Others of you may be involved in certain industry trade associations. For example, I was in Chicago last week at the Construction Safety Council's Expo. And with all this information, can-do employees belong to various social media communities for specific industries on the web. They listen and watch webcasts and teleseminars on industry topics. They're always reading new books that come out pertaining to industry and self-development. You will also find that they are subscribers and readers of trade journals and magazine articles about the industry that they work. You'll often find that asking for or finding new tasks or helping someone else is what they're involved in. They find it very difficult to sit around and do nothing. The can-do employee is also creative. If they are not working with their hands, they are most certainly working with their head. They try to think of better ways to do something. I guess in reality, they may be a little lazy because they're always seeking an easier, less complicated ways of doing a task. You'll also find that generally they are organized and they have a clean work area. it's that good laziness that they tend to have. They don't want to waste a whole lot of time and energy looking for something. They don't like to be frustrated. That is a waste of time. They want to be able to find something when they need it without going through the hassle of having to look at it. And then, and this is not the final characteristic, I'm sure you can find different characteristics in different people and in a can-do employee, but the final one that I want to highlight here in reference to a can-do employee is honesty and integrity. Honesty and integrity is more than just telling the truth. It is doing the best work that you can without somebody having to watch over your shoulder. Being dishonest and not having integrity is when an employee is holding back because they are afraid of working more than others and not be rewarded for it. Can-do employees are often found sitting down with the supervisor or boss and ask about the chances for advancement and raises and how to accomplish them. Some of the honesty and integrity characteristics of a can-do employee include working at an above standard pace, clocking in on time rather than having co-workers clock in for them when they're late, not pilfering work-related supplies and equipment, not using extended breaks and restroom visits, completing personal tasks off the job rather than on the job, and using company equipment and supplies, including the telephone and internet for their own benefit. A can-do employee can be very helpful in reference to your safety department, in any department. But since we're talking specifically about safety today, we want to know how that can-do employee can be a bonus to the safety department. And as you can tell, dependable, good attitude, willingness to work, productive, honesty, integrity, they are your future leaders in regards to the safety culture that you are trying to establish. So you need to work with them. You need to get their input and allow them to be beneficial to your organization. The second type of employee is what I call a can't-do employee. And now we're on the fourth slide. The can't-do employee is an employee that is often encountered, but is also probably, I would have to say, the most misunderstood. Many times their can't-do behavior is attributed to lack of willingness or a lack of intelligence. But they are a special type of employee because with the right type of treatment, they become a can-do employee. The problem? Usually it is the attitude of the supervisor or management. Too many times I've seen supervisors with the attitude that if you provide enough negative consequences to an employee that isn't getting the job done, they'll figure out that they better be doing and what they should be doing. In reality, the supervisory echelon is shirking their duty in regards to what they are actually supposed to be accomplishing. You see, a supervisor's role is that of a coach. Their job is to make sure that the employee succeeds at the task that they've been given. And many times I've seen supervisors with an attitude of, I'm the boss and I know what you are supposed to be doing and you had better listen to me or you're going to be in trouble. Now don't get me wrong, not all supervisors have that attitude. Fortunately, most don't. But a few bad apples can cause harm in regards to behavioral and attitudinal issues for years to come. A good supervisor figures out why an employee can't do the job and what needs to be done to fix it. Some reasons why employees can't do the job. First of all, they don't know how. Some employees have simply not been trained adequately. We all have a learning style, and some learn better simply by being told. Others need to see it done first so they can emulate the task, while others need to use a hands-on approach. The area of concern that I've encountered is too often that the supervisor uses the teaching method that they are most comfortable with, and then become frustrated when the employee doesn't accomplish the task. Remember, I said that the role of a supervisor is that of a coach. Very often, the employee wants to do a good job. They are motivated to accomplishing the task at hand, and these employees are looking for ways to learn more, and they won't resent being coached and trained. They are can-do employees in the making, and how supervisors deal with them in the phase of teaching them how to do the job will either have a positive or a negative impact on their learning in the future. The other reason that there are can't-do employees is they don't know what they're supposed to be doing. It's important that the supervisor be a good communicator. Oftentimes, the can't-do employees simply can't do the job because they don't know what it is that they're supposed to be doing. It can be a very frustrating thing to want to, but not know what to do. It is the supervisor's responsibility to communicate clearly to the employee what it is that they want to do and how. It is advisable to allow employees that know what it is that they are supposed to do within parameters to figure out how to accomplish a task. But here we're talking about an employee that needs more guidance than that. It's okay to give a little more hand-holding for this type of employee because the benefits that you will derive from that hand-holding is immeasurable. And then finally, the last reason a can't-do employee exists is because they think they are doing the job. How about employees that think they are doing the job where in reality they're not? This, once again, is most probably the fault of the supervisor. They have not communicated effectively what it is that they want communicated. And there's nothing more frustrating for an employee that thinks they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, but in the end, they find out that they aren't. The important fact is that questions are going to be the answer in particular to a can't-do employee. The important thing to remember with this type of employee, or really any type of employee, really, is that the questions you're going to be asking them. With a can't-do employee, it would be so easy to always tell them what, how, and when to do something. But what happens is that even when they become a can-do employee, we will still treat them like a can't-do employee. Remember, the job of supervision should be that of a coach. We want the end result of an employee who is able to think for themselves, take action, and be proactive. Kind of sounds like a can-do employee type to me. The problem seems to be we spend so much time treating employees to be buffaloes. Here's what I mean. The characteristic of a buffalo is to wait around for the leader. That is why during the settling of the West that the buffalo hunter was able to exterminate mass quantities of buffalo. They learned the secret to hunting them. All they had to do was pinpoint the lead buffalo, eliminate the lead buffalo, and the rest of the herd would mill around waiting for the lead buffalo to do something. Well, in the meantime, they were being picked off one by one. The supervisor who learns to ask questions will teach a can't-do employee how to become a can-do employee. The mistake that is often made, however, is when an employee is asked a question and they reply, "I don't know," we figured that we had better answer the question for them. I believe that is a mistake that we commit to our employees and even our children. And we wonder why they are so incompetent at times. Here's an example. I have a nephew that loves that phrase. I don't know, but I have learned not to let him get off the hook. Whenever he answers my questions that way, I look at him and I say, "Well, Matthew, if you did know, what would you do or say?" It's amazing. He then gives me an answer. We need to learn to quit letting our employees and our kids off the hook and holding them accountable for coming up with solutions and answers. We'll talk more about questions as we move through the material because it is the most important aspect of the resolutionary process that I'm going to be talking to you about. If you learn how to ask questions, you will teach employees to think for themselves. If you learn to ask questions, you will help employees stay safer. Because instead of looking to someone else to take responsibility for what's going on, they will start to take responsibility for themselves. A can't-do employee is not an employee that doesn't want to do a good job. For those reasons that I talked about, they don't know how, they don't know what they're supposed to be doing, or they think they are doing a good job. Those are the reasons that they are a can't-do employee. And by asking the appropriate questions, what's going to happen is we're going to have a can-do employee. If we take a look at slide 5 now, we're going to talk about the third type of employee that I call the won't-do employee. And you're always going to have this type of employee. They have the training, the skills, the ability. The thing is that they just won't do the job. This type of employee is probably one of the most frustrating employees of this bunch. If they would put in a quarter of the effort to do the job, rather than thinking of ways to avoid it, they would probably be pretty good employees. Why won't they do the job? Well, I've come up with some reasons that they've come up with over the years. I made a list of these. Some of the reasons they are won't do employees is because they are lazy. They're dishonest. They think that it's owed to them not to work. Maybe they think they put in the time already and the newbie needs to be doing the job or somebody with less experience. Some of them think they're smarter than the supervisor. They should probably have the supervisor's job instead. They use the excuse that, well, nobody else is working. Maybe they don't think that they're paid enough or they're paid too much. They think the work is stupid. They may be bored. They have better things to do. Maybe the expectation is low. Maybe they aren't expected to work. Maybe they aren't expected to succeed. That becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Maybe it's not their job, or they aren't educated enough, or maybe they think they're too educated. Maybe because of union rules, they won't do something or can't accomplish something. Sometimes they think that someone else had been doing the job. Maybe they didn't know they were supposed to do the job, or they didn't think they should do the job. Maybe they don't like the work, the supervisor, the manager, the coworker, whoever might be in the way. They don't like them, so they're not going to do it. Maybe they don't think they're liked by the supervisor, manager, or coworker. They may think that they don't have enough time. They may think they have too much time. Nobody knows what they're supposed to do. Maybe they don't know what they're supposed to do. This is not an exclusive list, and I'm sure that you've heard a few excuses yourself that is not on this list. I kind of get a laugh every time I watch the TV show MASH. And if any of you watch that, and you see Klinger. Klinger's trying to get out of the Army, and he's got all these excuses why he should get out of the Army, you know, and some of his relatives, they've died two or three times. You know, sometimes employees seem to be like that as well. And I also don't want you to be under the impression that using this process that I'm talking about, the resolutionary process, is going to completely eliminate this type of employee either. I do, however, know by handling them using a resolutionary process that you'll be able to turn more of them into can-do employees and take the stress off of you in regards to what to do about them and place the responsibility back into their laps. Now, I'm going to focus my attention more on the won't-do employee in regards to safety than on the other two. The process is the same for all of our employees, but I assume that won't-do employees probably give you the greater amount of grief that you have. And so I'm going to look at how to deal with those type of employees because, you know, those are the type of employees that you run through a disciplinary process most of the time anyway. So we're moving from a disciplinary process into a resolutionary process. On slide number 6, I want to take a look at some root causes. Let's examine some of those root causes of why an employee falls into the category of a won't-do employee. Let's talk a little bit about attitude. What type of attitude do a lot of your won't-do employees have? They have poor attitudes. And, you know, a lot of us, we may have grown up in an atmosphere that had a poor attitude, and we grew up and we kept that poor attitude, and we just spread it around to everyone that we can, that poor attitude. But I want you to understand that is only an excuse. You need to understand that, but you also need to understand the root cause of that attitude. They have a poor attitude because their friends have a poor attitude. They hang around friends at work that are always complaining about the job, or they're complaining about the supervisor, or they're complaining about the safety regulations that they need to follow through with. And so they get this poor attitude, and it's hard to hide. I mean, it comes out in everything that they do and everything that they're involved with. So you need to watch an employee's attitude. Another root cause has a lot to do with their personal background. And their personal background will also have a lot to do with an employee's attitude. Maybe they have a low self-esteem. They have a low self-esteem because their supervisors doesn't believe in them, doesn't want to take the time to work with them. And what happens is that an employee gets a low self-esteem, and I can guarantee you that an employee with a low self-esteem will do poor work. I come from a background, I did a lot of work in the contract janitorial industry for a number of years. And contract janitorial is quite a bit different than an in-house janitorial, because a lot of times contract janitorial is jobs are done on a cost basis. They're put out on bid, jobs are picked up by cost. Most employees are paid on minimum wage, and they come from a background of low minimum wage that does not enhance their self-esteem. And because of that, that background that I came from, we had, and this is an industry normal, we had a 300% turnover rate on an annual basis. That's normal for contract janitorial. When you have employees that don't feel good about themselves, don't feel good about their work and life, they have a low self-esteem. Now, an employee with a low self-esteem will be a problem in safety. They generally don't care about themselves. They don't care about other people. And what happens is with this self-esteem and really not caring, they are less likely to adhere to the policies and the regulations that are out there. So we need to understand, depending upon their background and the way you can tell an employee that has a low self-esteem by the way they say things, by the way they walk, the way they talk, you can tell whether or not they have a low self-esteem. Maybe it's previous experience. Maybe they worked someplace where a supervisor verbally abused them or mistreated them in some way. And, you know, no matter where we go in life, we all take our baggage with us. And if we've had a bad experience, we will generally see everything through the rose-colored glasses of that bad experience. What happens is that if we've had a supervisor that has verbally abused us, when we move on to another job, our expectation most of the time is that, well, that's just the way that supervisor is. So when you as a safety supervisor or a safety manager walk up to an employee and you start talking to them about wearing their personal protective equipment or following a certain procedure, what's going on in their mind is that, oh, he's cutting me down. He's bad-mouthing me. I bet he tells everybody about what a poor employee I am. And even though that's not true, and I'm hoping it's not true, even though that is not true, that's the way the employee sees it. They have this perception. The next one is they get poor feedback. You know, if you're always telling an employee that they're doing a bad job and they need to correct it, but you never tell them exactly how to correct it, then what happens is that they don't have the information that they need in order to do the job or get the job done in the manner that you want to have it done. We need to make sure that we are talking to employees, telling them about our expectations. And, you know, in the resolutionary process, we need to be asking more questions than we are telling them. Feedback is an important part of that. But what's even more important is that they are giving us the information in this feedback. And I apologize, I use that term feedback. It's not the word that I want to use, and I'll talk more about that in a little bit. But we've got to be careful. We've got to quit giving them feedback. You think that's pretty strange? What am I supposed to do if I don't give an employee feedback? Well, you'll see. I'll talk about that. And then finally, another root cause may have to do with the nature of work. I talked about contract, janitorial. Think about some of those occupations that employees do that they take no pride in, or the general public does not take pride in. So those are some of the root causes that can cause problems through their personal background. And then finally, it's job satisfaction. If an employee does not have job satisfaction, they're not going to accomplish the job in the manner that we want it to be accomplished, and they're not going to do the work in a safe manner as well. It all comes down to this: used people. We are all used people. It doesn't matter what position that you hold, whether you're a manager or a laborer, what industry that you work in, we are all used people. And here's what I mean by that. We have all had experiences. And most of the time what comes out on the job is those bad experiences that we have experienced, and we will react accordingly to those experiences. When it comes to safety, when it comes to discipline, if we don't wear our personal protective gloves and the supervisor comes up to us and writes us a disciplinary memorandum, say they give us a, it's past the warning already, may we have our the first disciplinary action. And I'm going to tell you something. This happened to me. Let me give you a good example. This was when I first started my career. I was actually working in the telemarketing industry, and I had been on the phones as a inbound agent. I wasn't one of those people that called you at supper time. I was one of those individuals that you called me to order something. And I'm on the phone, and I was doing a good job, so they promoted me to supervisor. And if you knew me, I'm kind of a easy to get along with guy. I like to have fun. This one day, I was standing by my team. I had 12 agents, inbound agents that were part of my team. And I was standing there. I had just got back from lunch, and the maintenance guy had been in the area while I was gone, had set up a ladder, had climbed up the ladder, changed the light bulb. And when they had left, for whatever reason, they left the ladder there, they left their tools there, they just left everything set there in my area. And I jokingly said to my agents, I said, you know, it's hard to find good help nowadays. Look at all the stuff they leave around. Well, the young man that I had said that about, he didn't know me very well. I didn't know him very well. I'm just joking around. But he went to his supervisor, made a complaint. And by the end of the day, I found myself sitting in my supervisor's office, and I was getting a disciplinary action written up on me because of what I said. And I'll never forget what my supervisor said to me. He said, Jay, you got to be careful what you say now because you're a supervisor. But none of that was making any sense to me. I was angry about what was happening. Now, if I had gone through life, and goodness, good to know that I hadn't been written up again. I've had a few run-ins with the supervisor before, but if I continue to take what I had learned in that last position that I had had as a supervisor, and I had looked through my rose-colored glasses as a supervisor at what was being done to me, that all supervisors and managers and other people, even people that worked for me, couldn't be trusted, they were like that, I'd end up with a pretty poor attitude. So, it's important that we understand the root causes of why our employees have, in regards to their attitude, things that have happened in their background, and their job satisfaction, in order to be able to better work with people. Remember, as a manager or supervisor, our job is not to go out and be Donald Trump and just fire people willy-nilly. Our job should be working with people, making sure that they remain safe, and giving them everything that they need to be successful in the job that they're doing. And you know, taking a look at slide number 7, the impact of supervision, the supervisor is probably one of the, well, they are the most important person in reference to how an employee is going to act. The sad thing is that unfortunately a lot of supervisors get promoted to supervisor because they were good at their job. My friends, that does not mean that they're going to be a good supervisor. That just simply means that now they've got a title, and unless they have been trained appropriately, they're just going to have the title but not know how to do the job. Now, there's two types of supervisors, of course. The first one is the ineffective supervision. The ineffective supervisor, most of the time, is either over-supervising employees, and there's reasons that they may over-supervise employees. They may over-supervise employees because they want to look good to the boss, or it could be that they are micromanagers and they don't trust employees, so in order to make sure the employee does a job and does the job right and gets everything done, that they have to have their thumb down on top of them all the time to make sure that they're getting the job done. Also, ineffective supervision includes under-supervising. And why would a supervisor under-supervise? They would under-supervise because they don't want their employees to be mad at them. They don't want to look like they're picking on them. They want to be a part of the gang yet. They don't want to rock the boat. The problem is that in safety, you do not want to over-supervise or under-supervise people. You don't want to be too overbearing or too underbearing. So you need to become an effective supervisor. Now, under effective supervision, there's a couple things I want you to be aware of. The first one is what I call the radio station that we all listen to. We all listen to the radio station WIIFM. From the morning, from the time in the morning that we get up to the time at night that we go to bed, we are always listening to that radio station. WIIFM simply stands for this: what's in it for me? You see, as human beings, we don't do anything unless there's something in it for us. Some of you are on this phone call today, but the only reason you're on this conference today is because there's something in it for you. Maybe you thought it might be a good way to get out doing some work, so you'll hop on a teleconference. Some of you probably want to learn about what's this about getting rid of this disciplinary process all about. That's nonsense. And so you got on the line either to blow this theory out of the water or to learn about it so that you can implement it. That's the reason you're on the call. Some of you may be on the teleconference because your boss said you need to listen to that, or, you know, maybe you should just find employment elsewhere. I hope you understand what I'm saying. You are on this phone call for a reason. Whatever is in it for you, that's the reason you're here. Now understand this. Your employees are the very same way. Your employees will only do something because there's something in it for them. The only reason that they will follow through on safety policies or safety procedures is because there's something in it for them. And if there's not something in it for them, or they're not convinced that there's something in it for them, they will not follow through. So as an effective supervisor, you need to figure out what's in it for your supervisors, or what's in it for your employees to follow through in regards to what it is that they do or accomplish, or whether or not, why or why not, they're following the safety rules and policies. Secondly, as an effective supervisor, you need to understand the strengths and the weaknesses of your employees. All of your employees have a certain strength in something. I can pretty much guarantee you they also have a certain weakness somewhere. And you are probably the very same way. I know I am. I have some strengths that I know that if you give to me or you want me to accomplish, I will get it done. That's my strength. But you don't want to give me something, for example, something that is of great detail because that's a weakness of mine. A good example is when I used to do, or I was in charge of accomplishing safety audits, a safety inspection, assessment. And, you know, I'm one of these big picture type of guys. I can sit down and I can put together a program, but when it goes out to actually looking at a site and looking for a specific, or not just specific things, but a wide range of things, that's not, being into the detail is not one of my strengths. That's one of my weaknesses. So as a manager, I would find people who had an eye for detail that I would have do the assessments for me in my safety departments. So you need to understand the employee strengths and weaknesses, and you need to use those strengths and weaknesses to your advantage. You always want to combine somebody with a strength that will compensate for the weakness of another employee. And by doing that, you are generally going to get the job done and get it accomplished in the way that you want to have it accomplished. Now, before I go any further, I am going to get a hold, I'm going to have Jordan come back online, and I want to stop here and answer any questions that you may have currently at this time. And while we're waiting to queue up for questions, I want to tell you how important it is to create that culture within the organization. And a lot of what we're talking about today has to do with the culture of the organization. And a culture really needs to come from the floor up. It needs to be supported from the top down, but come from the floor up. And so we'll talk more about how the additional stuff that we're going to be talking about really feeds into that culture. Great. Then I will go ahead and continue on. Let's go ahead and move on to slide number 8. And let's talk about language. Now, I want you to think about the impact of language. Let's first explore the verbiage of discipline and the disciplinary process. The dictionary definition of discipline is it is punishment inflicted by way of connection and training. It's an instrument of punishment, especially a whip or a scourge used in the practice of self-mortification or as an instrument of chastisement in certain religious communities, or it's to punish or penalize in order to train and control, correct, or chastise. Whether you want to admit it or not, this is the definition that we have grown up with. When you hear the word discipline, most people will think of discipline in a negative aspect. Now, the other thing about discipline is that it's a way that you can conduct yourself along rigid lines, but that's not the discipline that people think of when we talk about disciplinary process. For example, when I hear the word discipline, here's what goes through my head. And remember this, I'm almost 50 years old. And what goes through my head is that either I'm bent over the bed and my dad has his belt, or my mom's made me go out to the willow tree to get my own willow stick. and I'm going to get a spanking. Matter of fact, when there were days that I knew I was going to be especially bad, I would wear a couple extra pairs of shorts just in case. But that's what goes through my mind. So today, if someone would come up to me, or like when I was given a disciplinary action by my supervisor when I was working for the telemarketing company, when I heard that, going through my mind was, I'm not a kid. I'm not a kid, I'm an adult. You can't treat me this way. And so what I did was I folded my arms, I stuck my chin out, and I got an attitude. That's what happens when people today hear the word disciplinary action. I guarantee you, the majority of them will view it as a negative word, and they will get a negative attitude, and they will learn nothing, absolutely nothing, from what you're trying to accomplish. We do not want to punish people. Well, yeah, let me rephrase that. We probably feel that some people need to be punished, but here's what I'm going to tell you. We need to get away from that type of thinking. We need to move away from a disciplinary type process. We need to move away from punishing people, and instead we need to start learning how to teach people. Because once we learn how to teach people, we will have a much easier job of accomplishing the task that we are attempting to accomplish. So let's take a look at the second part of the language on the next slide, and let's talk about the resolutionary process. Let's look at the verbiage of resolution in the phrase resolutionary process. It is the act of resolving or determining upon an action or a course of action, method or procedure, or etc. It is a solution, accommodation, or settling of a problem or controversy. Now, sitting there, think about the different feeling that you get when you hear a word dealing with resolving something compared to the word discipline. If you're honest, as you're sitting here, when you hear the word discipline, you will have a different reaction than when you hear the word resolution. I get the distinct impression that disciplining is doing something to, while resolving is doing something with. And as we are creating a culture, we want a culture where we are working together to accomplish something. A disciplinary action has too much negativity attached to it. With a negative type of usage of a word, that's the outcome that we're going to get, is a negative outcome. You know, you probably think that you're getting stuff done by using a disciplinary process, and you probably are. I'm not saying that you've been doing it wrong all these years, that it's not something that needs to be done. Here's what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to say that if we will change the language, I believe that we will get better results. Not only do I believe that, but I've seen that. I've been involved in safety, facility management, human resources for many, many years. And when we moved away from a disciplinary process, the usage of that language, and we moved into a process of using a resolutionary process where supervisors and managers would start working with employees, helping them to be accountable and responsible by asking them questions rather than telling them. We found that we had less turnover and that fewer people had to be let go from the company, which in the end saved money on the bottom line. Because when you have a high turnover rate, what occurs is that you've got to advertise to rehire people, and then you've got to put them through the training. You spend all that time and all that money. And by retaining employees, working through a resolutionary process, we were able to cut the expenses on the bottom line and have more of a profit to put back into the organization. So changing the language, but not just changing the language is going to be important. Changing the language and then following different steps. And this is not just good for the employee, but it's good for the supervisor as well. If you have a supervisor that knows that they have to put an employee through a disciplinary process sometime that day, what are they going to spend their time thinking? They're going to spend their time thinking what they're going to say, how they're going to say it, how they're going to deal with their attitude, how they're going to deal with their emotions. But instead, if you have a supervisor thinking about a resolutionary process that they want to discuss with an employee, they're going to be spending time thinking about the situation and some solutions to that situation. Most supervisors, when they think of a disciplinary process, many of them think that this is just a formal step to the next step, to the last step, to get rid of an employee. And that should not be the goal whatsoever. So I'm saying that to get rid of the thinking that we've had, that supervisors have, that employees have, we need to move away from the language that we're using, and we need to use a different type of language. If we take a look at the next slide, slide number 10, I want to talk about the process. It's all about coaching. It's all about coaching. The first thing about coaching is that we need to learn to ask questions. And let's say that we have an employee, and let's say that for whatever reason, we have an issue with this employee who will not wear their personal protective equipment. Let's say that they will not wear their gloves. And so the way that we generally do it is we go to the employee, we tell them, you know, you're not wearing your gloves. We are required by guidelines, we're required by policy to wear our gloves at all times while doing this job. And because you are not wearing your gloves, I need to write you up. I need to put you through a disciplinary process. What if instead we went to that employee and we started asking them questions? So we come to the employee, they're not wearing their gloves. Let's say the employee's name is John. I come up to John and I say, John, I see you're not wearing your gloves. You do know that you are supposed to be wearing your gloves while you're doing this process, don't you? You know, and if we've been doing our jobs as safety managers, as supervisors, that are going to say, yeah, I know that. John, let me ask you something. If something should happen to you while you're doing this work and you're not wearing your gloves, and I ignored this, or I didn't catch you before you got injured, how would your family feel about this? Would they blame me? How would they feel towards you, John? Now, when I'm asking John questions, I'm not just rambling on. I'm waiting for him to answer. I want John to give me the answer. Because I'm leading John down a path that I want him to go to. I don't want to stand before John and say, John, wear your gloves. I want John to tell me that he's going to wear his gloves. Because John will tend to believe what he's saying 100 times more than what I'm saying. So I'm asking John, how would your family feel? Well, they probably wouldn't be happy. John, how would you feel if I let something happen to you? Would you be happy about that? Well, no, I probably wouldn't be happy about that. Let me ask you something, John. You do know that I don't talk to you about wearing your gloves just because I have nothing better to do and I just want to get on your case. You do know that I have a purpose for telling you, don't you? Well, yeah, I know that. But tell me, John, why do I want you to wear your gloves? Well, because if I don't, OSHA's going to find us and it's going to cost the company money. Well, John, that's partially right. It is an OSHA regulation that you should be wearing those gloves. You know that, don't you? Well, yeah. Okay, John, what's another reason why I talk to you about wearing your gloves? Well, it's so something doesn't happen to me. That's right. Now, John, there's got to be a reason why you're not wearing your gloves. Tell me, why is it? What is stopping you from wearing your gloves? Now, you see, during this process, as I'm asking John these questions, something may come up that I didn't know about before. You see, obviously, John's not wearing his gloves, so he's not a can-do employee. However, I need to determine whether John is a can't-do employee or a won't-do employee. And if John said something to the effect that, well, they're too small, I can't wear them, they're uncomfortable, you know what I've just learned? I've just learned that John is probably a can't-do employee, and probably what I need to do is I need to do something about the size of gloves that John is wearing. By changing the gloves that he's wearing, now I have easily turned John into a can-do employee from a can't-do employee. That's why understanding the type of employee that they are is important, because it's going to indicate to you just how much of this process it's going to take. Now, if I was just writing John up, if I was just taking him through a disciplinary process and he wasn't wearing his gloves, I probably wouldn't even care why he wasn't wearing his gloves. All I would care about was that he wasn't wearing them. He should be, and so, you know, I'm going to have to write you up. But because I'm using a resolutionary process and I'm asking questions, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, what can I ask them that will help me understand better so we can resolve the issue, so that we can work together? And John tells me, well, the gloves don't fit. I said, John, I'm glad you told me that. Now, here's what I want you to do. If some sort of personal protective equipment that you're wearing doesn't fit, or there's a problem with it, will you tell me next time? See, I'm using this as a moment to teach John to be able to reach out to me so we don't have these types of issues again. So I'm asking him questions and I'm getting him involved and committed. I'm going to ask him, John, other than the gloves not fitting, is there any other reason why you won't wear your gloves? And John will probably say, well, no, that's the reason my gloves don't fit. That's why I don't wear them. Now, I have a form that I use. So when I am going through a resolutionary process with John, generally what I've done is I have sat down with John And I've gone through this. And I said, John, you know, we're going through a resolutionary process. We need to work this issue out. The issue is that you are not wearing your personal protective equipment when you're supposed to. And the reason for that, you tell me, is because your gums don't fit. Now, is there any other reason that will not help you accomplish what it is that you need to do? And John is saying, no, that's the reason. So I've gotten him involved in the process by asking him questions that he's given me answers to. I've gotten him to commit to that. And now we're going to move into a follow-up accountability process. Because I'm going to say, now, John, you understand now that you need to wear your gloves, or if there's a problem with your personal protective equipment fitting, you need to let somebody know in management what the problem is. Do not go to work and work unsafely until that issue is resolved. Okay? And John will say, I understand that. I'll say, John, here's the deal. You are now responsible, and I'm going to hold you accountable for what it is that you've told me. I'm going to sign off on this resolutionary process. I want you to sign off for it. Understand that if you do not follow through with what you've just told me, then we're going to have to move to the next part of the process. You do understand that, don't you, John? And John will say, I understand that. And so I'll give him a copy of it, and we both have our signatures, which has allowed us to commit, and more importantly, has allowed the employee to commit to the issue. Now, the next question is what happens if you have a won't-do employee? Well, you're going to use the same process. You have a won't-do employee, and you're going to ask them the same types of questions. Well, John, why aren't you wearing your gloves? Well, I don't want to. John, you do understand that you do need to wear your gloves while you're doing this process, don't you? Yeah, I know that, but I just don't want to, and I'm not going to. You can't make me. Well, John, let me ask you a question. If I allowed you to do your work and you were not wearing your personal protective equipment like you should, how would your family feel if something should happen to you? Oh, I don't know. I don't care. How would you feel, John? Would you blame me? Would you try to sue the company? Well, yeah, I probably. You see, my whole process is to get employees to think that there's a reason why I'm doing what it is that I'm doing. The other thing that I want to talk about, if we take a look at slide number 11, is I want to talk about a process of what I call feed forward. You see, we use a word called feedback. And the changing of language, if we change from the language of feedback to feed forward, allows us now to focus on a solution rather than on a mistake, to focus on the future rather than focusing on the past. And the definition of a feed forward is focusing on solutions rather than mistakes, on the future rather than the past. It also enhances the self-image of business leaders and employees alike and propel them on the road to success, which is the same thing that a resolutionary process does. Because a resolutionary process, instead of using a negative aspect to accomplish what it is that we want to accomplish, we're using a positive aspect. Take a look at slide 12, feedback. Let's compare the word feedback. There have generally been two levels of feedback. There's what we call downward feedback, which is information communicated from supervisors, managers, and management to their employees. And then there's upward feedback. And that's feedback from employees to management. The problem with feedback is that it is generally focused on the past, on what has already occurred. If we take a look at slide 13, feed forward, the benefits, therefore, of using a feed forward process is it will allow you to focus on the future. You're not looking at what has already occurred. Instead, using feed forward, you're focusing on the future, on the solution or the resolution that you've come up with. Instead of saying, next time you need to do this, instead using feed forward, you're going to ask a question. Next time, what do you feel you need to do? And the employee, thinking upon the future rather than in a disciplinary process, the mistake that has been made, will now focus on the future rather than on the past. Also on feedforward, it focuses on employee-generated solutions. That's why the questions. You're asking them questions. Now, like I had said earlier, you're never going to completely get rid of the won't do employee. And eventually that won't do employee will have to move on. But by asking questions, you have a better chance of helping an employee become more focused on the solution rather than on the mistakes that have been made and start generating solutions. Now, you can ask employees in such a way, for example, if you say something to the fact, you know, John, I appreciate that you don't like wearing those gloves, but let me ask you a question. Is there something else that could be done rather than wearing personal protective equipment that could be done to make this job safer so employees don't have to wear gloves? And what I'm doing is I am taking the responsibility and I'm putting back into John's lap. What I want John to do is I want him to think if there are other procedures or if this is the most feasible solution that there is. If I'm telling John that he needs to do this, and in the back of his mind, he's thinking that, you know, I have a goal in mind that I want them to do, and I'm going to get rewarded for it. He's not going to be thinking about what benefit he's going to be getting. But if I help John realize that what I'm telling him is the best solution, then John will start to figure out, hopefully, what's in it for him. The other thing is that maybe there is a better way. But unless I've asked John to give me his thoughts on the matter, I may not think of it myself. And it's going to cost me time and money because of that. So it's important that I focus on employee-generated solutions by asking questions. Feed forward is also aimed at helping them achieve their goals. If I'm asking questions about going home safe at night, not becoming injured, give me feedback about how, or feed forward on how he would feel if something should happen to him. I'd say, John, let's move forward a week from now. Let's say that you've cut yourself badly, you can't go back to work. How are you going to be feeling? What are your goals for the future? What do you want to get out of accomplishing the job safely? I'm going to help him achieve his goals. The other thing with feedforward is that it cannot be taken personally. You can't. Feedback is where I'm telling you something. For example, with the definition of feedback is that it's communicated from supervisors or management to employees, I'm talking to them and I'm telling them, then it's easy to get construed to be negative, to be taken personally. However, if I'm asking for feedback, if I'm asking for John for input, if I'm saying, John, tell me what you think of this. John, tell me what you want about that. And I'm getting this feed forward from him. He can't take it personally because most of what's happening is being directed towards me. It's not me being directed towards him. The other thing is that the assumption is that there will be a positive change. Now, you can try to look for a positive change using a disciplinary process, but disciplinary is a negative word from the get-go anyway, and so you've already planted that seed. Using a resolutionary process, using a feed-forward, it has a positive connotation, and you're planting that positivity seed. And the assumption is now that there will be a positive change. The other thing is that it makes employees responsible for the outcome. If I am talking to John, and I'm saying, John, what do you think needs to be done next time in reference to making sure that you wear your personal protective equipment? Or what needs to be done next time so we don't have this type of incident or we don't have another near miss? When John comes up with the answers about what needs to be done and what needs to be accomplished, and I agree with him, he has now become responsible for following through. And I make sure he understands that. You want to make sure that when employees tell you what they're going to do, you need to make sure that you're going to hold them accountable to that. That's, you want them to come up with the decision, the solution, and that you're going to hold them responsible for that outcome. And feed forward can be used at every level. It can be used from management or supervisor to the employee, or it can be used from employee to employer. It just needs to be done in a way that it is not accusatory, it's not perceived to be attacking anyone. It is simply an exchange of ideas and of information. And so, in this culture that we've been talking about, you want to use the resolutionary process, because in a resolutionary process, what occurs is that everybody is working toward a solution. It doesn't matter whose fault it is. What matters is what is the solution that is going to be decided upon. How is the situation going to be resolved by the input that's going to be given? And we're not using a negative connotation. Now, you know, there will be some negativity in the end, but that's only because an employee has chosen that there's going to be negativity. If we take a look at slide number 14, we're going to talk about the process of responsibility and what people are responsible for. And I have changed, once again, the language. You see, nothing has really changed when it comes to OSHA. I had someone contact me by email several days ago and says, you know, OSHA wants to have a process that escalates and needs to be in writing, and nothing's changed. The only thing that has changed is the language and how we're using the language to build up the organization rather than tear down the organization or an individual. Instead of a verbal warning, we have a verbal feed forward. Same thing, but how we conduct it by using questions rather than telling is what makes it different. We have a first written feed forward rather than a first written warning. We have a second written feed forward with time off. And then I never fire anybody. I free up their future to go work someplace else. Here's what I'm trying to say. So you have an OSHA inspector that sits down and he says, you know, I want to see your disciplinary process that you have. This is the time that you start to educate them a little bit. You say, Mr. OSHA compliance officer, I actually call it a resolutionary process. We work with employees to have them help come up with solutions for behavior. We sit down with them, we get their input, we share ideas. They are held responsible for this process. And throughout this entire process, for whatever reason, if the employee still does not want to do what they have said they know to do and should do and have taken responsibility to get it done, then we have allowed them to follow through with their decision to free up their future to work elsewhere. And what we generally do is we finish up the paperwork and they go somewhere else to work. So nothing has really changed from a progressive disciplinary process. All we've used is a progressive resolutionary process. That all we're trying to do is we are trying to come to a resolution of what it is that we're trying to get accomplished, that we're trying to move forward. Paperwork is the same. You might change the wording on the paperwork. You hold them responsible, but nothing's changed. We've all moved into more of a positive attribute. This time I'm going to ask Jordan to find out if anybody has any questions at this time. And while you're doing that, I just want to bring your attention to the last couple of slides. If you would complete an evaluation for me, if you simply go to the website of www.tinyurl.com/resolutionary-process, just fill out the evaluation for me. That would be absolutely great. That way I can better serve you and others that I do teleconferences for in the future. And then the last slide has to do with, I'm missing something. Also, I'm giving away a free ebook. I'm writing a book on the subject and it should be done within the next 60 days. If you would like to have a copy of that, send a blank email to resolutionaryprocess@encouragingsafety.com. And when the book is completed, it will automatically be sent to you by email. Just send a blank email to that address. Then my contact information, if you want to talk to me about anything else, is at the end of that as well. So, questions? Okay, Jordan, then I want to thank everybody for attending today. Like I said, make sure that you contact me with my contact information. If you have any questions, I'd love to be a resource for you. And with that, I'll let Jordan close us out. Okay. Did we have anybody on the line? Okay. Okay. It's Yeah, I know it gets kind of hard to stretch it out for 2 hours, especially if you don't have any feedback. Or feed forward, I guess. Sounds good. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.